With Stephen Wirth, the co-author of Blood Oath, The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, softcover, Rainbow Books, 1996. Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, softcover, Dove, 1995. And Donald Freed, along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, hardcover edition, Macmillan, copyright, 1996. Gentlemen, welcome back to our airwaves, and we've been engaging in a number of speculative items here. Stephen Singular, you were talking about Scott Barnes, this curious fellow who'd cropped up in connection with the case. The media impenetrability is something that we've already touched on and that you wrote about at considerable length. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about what you've been seeing in connection with the civil case so far.
Well, it plugs in, I guess, a bit to some of the things Donald was saying earlier. I mean, what I've seen in the case is an extension and deepening of what I saw in the whole throughout the whole criminal trial, which is not doesn't strike me as being just sort of a malfunctioning of what the media should be, at least in my opinion, but a breakdown of what it is and perhaps what it has been. And it always strikes me when you compare this to the Watergate situation that the media functioned appropriately at that time. That's almost a quarter of a century ago now, 24 years ago, starting, I guess, in June of 72. But it functioned as it should have functioned, and the work of two reporters at the start of that case, obviously Woodward and Bernstein, and then a lot of other people chipping in and helping, you know, brought to light a serious abuse of power and an undermining of our Constitution and a lot of other things that we're still learning about now, as you referred to earlier, some of the other things Nixon did. I see the media as totally not functioning in an appropriate manner here and breaking down all over the place. I mean, from watching the sort of standard shows of Charles Grodin, which Donald appeared on, or Geraldo Rivera, or Larry King, I mean, these dominate the nighttime airwaves. And I don't know. I just find it to be absolutely astonishing. For example, if you were to look at, I think it was Thursday night, mm-hmm. where you had Larry King interviewing Faye Resnick, mm-hmm. and saying, Faye, you know, what was your opinion about this case, you know, when you heard about these crimes? And she goes on to obviously repeat in parrot-like fashion what she has said over and over again. Well, I knew instantly that O.J. Simpson committed these crimes. You know, he doesn't question her. He doesn't say, where were you, you know, when you got the information? Happened to be sitting in a drug rehab clinic, yes. Et cetera, et cetera. There's not one follow-up question. Then you flip over to CNBC, and Geraldo is saying to Cato Kalin, well, Cato, what do you think happened? You know, these are not relevant questions to solving a criminal investigation. What was going on in Cato Kalin's mind,
yeah.
to me, is an adventure into insanity. That is not a serious, you know, investigation about what was the evidence that existed in this case, what should have been investigated. I mean, all of the things that we're talking about, if any appropriate investigation had been done by the people who were paid to do this, all of this information would be coming to light, or much of what we're talking about. But that, to me, was sort of the twin-headed monster that we're dealing with, that how many millions of people were sitting there watching Larry King asked this one question to Faye Resnick and Geraldo to Cato Kalin. And there is a lack of seriousness, a breaking down of how this technology and how the people associated with this technology are supposed to function that I think goes far, far beyond the O.J. Simpson case. And it runs upon, you know, in my opinion, the underlying fuel that all of this runs upon is race. And you simply have to push a couple of buttons out there, as the mainstream media has done, and there is still enough racial disharmony in this country to just, you know, lurch us further and further into racial anger, racial animosity, racial fear and racial violence, ultimately, probably.
The interesting item about Cato, I just want to interject this very briefly, in the book about Cato, I've forgotten the title and the author offhand.
Mark Elliott.
Yeah, Yeah, they're called Cato Speaks. That the same aforementioned researcher Bob Miller pointed out to me that on the night of the killings, Cato had been on the phone with a friend of his in San Diego, who was an assistant district attorney at the time in San Diego. Mm. This was before the thumps, and then after the thumps, for some reason, he called him back and continued the conversation. That same fellow is now an assistant DA in Los Angeles, whatever connection that may or significance that may or may not have.
David, talking about Cato Kalin, following up with Stephen Singler says, the media has not been objective at all. You know, while they're trying to pick apart O.J. Simpson on the stand, what they allow to slip by is Cato Kalin has changed his timeline from 10:40 in the grand jury, the preliminary, the criminal case, to what he told Mark Elliott, to now stretching it to 10:50, you know, to fit a pattern. But what also, and it's something I discovered in reading his testimony, he states he never looked at a clock, looked at a watch during that entire evening when he was on the phone with Rachel Ferrara. That's the girlfriend that supposedly he was going to meet up with. Except that at 10:30, in his testimony, in the criminal trial, in the preliminary, one of the things that comes up is that she asked him, what time is it? And he replies, because they were supposed to get together, it was getting late, it's 10:30. Now, a jurist or anybody would realize right then you couldn't say 10:30 unless you're looking at some timepiece, unless there's some kind of sundial that works at night. So that he had to be looking at. Now, that means his testimony, when he says he never looked at something, because that's the only way he can keep swinging this time. You know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes, et cetera. Then that testimony becomes untruthful.
So this is what I was going to say. In other words, wouldn't that mean if he changed his testimony, wouldn't one or the other constitute perjury?
Well, certainly this one where he says, as a matter of fact, something I just faxed to Robert Baker, the actual out of the testimony, and he said never. As a matter of fact, this is what's happened. Why, Mr. Kalin, did you at any time, and now nobody's asked anything yet, he didn't ask the question yet, I never looked at a clock. Now, he wasn't even asked the question yet. I can't hear you. I didn't look at a clock. At any time, no. Well, that's false. Because unless he got it off a sundial, when he was talking to Rachel Ferrara, he had to be looking at a clock. Now, what nobody asked during the criminal or during this is, at 10:30, because Rachel Ferrara said she was watching television, at 10:30 on the half hour, on the hour, anything like that, you normally get a change, something comes on the air, whatever program you want is interrupted. You can either watch a commercial or a new a station comes on. Nobody's brought that. Hopefully, when the defense puts their case on, they will bring Rachel Ferrara on to testify. I don't know whether she's on the list of people who can testify.
I don't know, but I do know that Stephen Wirth is speaking with great acuity because it's thanks to his research of the combined sources of the grand jury and the preliminary trial, the criminal trial, and various other interviews, that Cato Kalin is absolutely tied down. And I looked at Stephen Worth's research drawn from these combined sources, and I built a timeline minute by minute for those last few minutes of the killing time between 10 and 11 that night. And the defense has it, and the defense is using it. They are using Stephen Worth's research, without question. Now, whether they're going to be able, in their case in chief, to absolutely tie this down, because this discussion, as between pairs of shoes, hitting and slapping and so forth, all of this becomes a sideshow if there's not the window of opportunity for the murder. And that was what was established last week, unnoted by the press.
That's
now,
right.
Whether or not the defense can underline this or not is the question.
You know, that security code, one of the things, again, the defense, they called them a million, the dream team. I mean, they never used it, and I haven't seen the civil yet. Nobody has ever asked.
Can you explain that? Since the security alarm
should have been on. O.J. Simpson, you would have to have known he had come out of the house at least once. If Alan Park saw him re-enter the house without punching in the code.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Singer, you had a comment that you or a question you wanted to introduce.
I'm trying to clarify that in my mind, exactly what you're saying about that alarm, because that sounds very important.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you have is the alarm, the code is on the outside. In a lot of houses, you enter the door, and it's on inside. Yep. On O.J. Simpson's house, you punch in, and actually a red light comes on, the old-fashioned.
Yeah.
Normally, they don't have that anymore, but the red light comes on. Now, if O.J. Simpson left with Cato Kalin to go to McDonald's,
right. And
nobody's ever asked, did he set the alarm at that time? They've always asked after, when he told Cato to set it when he was leaving for the airport. If he set that alarm at that point, in order for him to come back, remember, they've now got this timeline set, at 10:50, O.J. climbing over the fence, coming up, and Alan Park sees him going across the driveway at 10:54, I think, .12, based on a cell phone. That's fixed. Or maybe it's 10:55. I have to check the time. But he walks right in the house because he then calls, and O.J. picks it up. He had to have stopped to disarm the code in order to get in the house, unless he's already been in the house and is coming back out again.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, he's been out once. Otherwise, that alarm's on. The alarm would have gone off as soon as he opened the door.
That was the punchline I was waiting for you to say. If he just walks into that house, that alarm goes off.
That's correct.
Mm.
Well, that's interesting.
Just 1 second, gentlemen. Okay. Proceed.
The other interesting thing, by the way, is Alan Park, for the first time, says he saw O.J. coming around the side of the building. Now, that becomes, I would think that Cato Kalin and O.J. Simpson are banging into each other.
Well, exactly. Their timelines would have crashed on the south side of the house.
That's correct.
That is exactly correct. Just as we realized that earlier, the timeline that's now been changed would have forced O.J. Simpson's timeline to crash with Alan Park's. Now, the plaintiffs have changed the timeline in order to escape that embarrassment, and they now are simply saying, in effect, take our word for it, that the light-colored car speeding away in the opposite direction of the Rockingham estate at 10:45 from the Bundy murder scene must have been O.J. Simpson. He would, within a minute, have turned around and therefore reached his Rockingham estate at about 10:51:30 or 10:52. Now, remember, at 10:52, both young men are already out in front, one looking for an intruder, the other looking for his celebrity client, the dog looking for his master. It's the one time when you cannot say that Alan Park might have been asleep or taking a walk or listening to rock music, because his telephone log to his mother and his boss tells us where he was and what he was doing, sitting in the limousine, pointed into the compound at the gate, from which point of view he can see the Rockingham gate, where Simpson must race up. And remember, the plaintiffs now no longer could argue that Simpson snuck in with lights off and motor off. There's not time for that now. They say he's racing against time. And in order to make those three thumps, which they were forced to either drop or try to manipulate to a later time, and that's what's fatal to their case. And the question is what the jury is seeing and understanding.
This again, is a jury that is weighted toward probably guilty. I sure as hell would never want to go in any kind of a trial as a defendant, civil or criminal, with a jury that was weighted probably guilty. I mean, that's a joke.
Well, you just saw, by the way, the same thing happened in Pittsburgh, where they picked an all-white jury,
right?
In the case with the SEALs, cousin or something, who was had his a chokehold put on him, and they just the people walked off. Now you can say it's racist, non-racist, what have you, but what happens is people not put in a certain situation will look at testimony in a way they feel most comfortable. I think Donald Freed's book, The Killing Time, the time, if you take and kind of put a shutter across the entire Bundy scene. Blot it out. Blot all of that evidence out, and now get to the point of, if O.J. Simpson is the person that Alan Park sees, and he supposedly has no axe to grind, at 10:55, because it's 10:55.12 seconds, going across that driveway, and the defense can now establish whether or not that alarm system was set prior to O.J. Simpson leaving. If that alarm was set, that means O.J. Simpson had to be in the house once before and back out. Mm. There is absolutely not enough time. If you give him even that the alarm was not set, let's go on the play devil's advocate, the alarm was not set, free to go in, that means he has to go upstairs, and in 6 minutes, because there's testimony by Alan Park, between 5 and 6 minutes, he was absolutely certain O.J. Simpson was down. He had a shower, I don't know whether he shaved or not,
but he had
a shower, changed his clothes, got everything packed, and downstairs
no on that
with his luggage.
There's no blood on the carpet. That was one of the things that came out in the criminal trial.
That's right.
There's no blood going up. I mean, those shoes, those Bruno Magli shoes, they have to have blood on them to leave the prints, right?
Mm. But not only that, Bruno Magli shoes on thick carpeting would have left footprints.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, one of the first things I asked Pavlik when I talked to him.
There's no blood there.
Those Bruno Maglis are a very, very different type of shoe. He would have had to, if he took his shoes off when he entered the house, he would to have least have had to been wearing them when he went down that staircase. They would have left those tread marks on without, even with no blood. If you've got thick carpeting, you step on it with a sneaker, you leave an imprint.
Mm.
The police would have taken pictures of it. Obviously, they didn't see it then.
One of the things, certainly had shoes on when he went into the house.
One of the things, James Joyce referred to the ineluctable modality of the visible. One of the things that has absolutely astounded me in this case is the ability of not only the legal authorities, the prosecution, but also the general public, courtesy of our media establishment, which is anything but objective, to absolutely disregard the obvious physical facts. When a person has their carotid artery cut, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, you know, it isn't just bleed, but jets of blood squirt out. And this is in a combat situation where the system is filled with adrenaline. The heart is slightly enlarged. It squirts out, and it squirts a long way. And two people had their carotid arteries cut. When you look at the pictures of the crime scene, there's blood all over the place. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's been smeared around. I mean, it's people were walking in it or struggling in it. That crime scene was a bloody goddamn mess, and yet, where are the clothes? Where's the blood? You got a little bit of blood here, a little bit of blood there. It is so ridiculous. Anyone that's ever seen an industrial accident or an automobile accident and seen serious bleeding knows it does. And when you look at the pictures of the crime scene, there's all that blood there. One of the people had to have been killed first. I mean, they didn't both get killed at exactly the same time by one killer, right?
Well, that's right.
Somebody walks into that little walkway up to Nicole's. One of them is dead and bleeding, and you know, what do? They go, huh, you know, I wonder what this is. Gosh, you know, maybe I better go. You know, it's just the notion that either Nicole or Ron, one of them had to go first, could have seen the other there and not immediately. You know, you think Nicole wouldn't have called 911? I mean, it is astounding. And then, when O.J. tried on the gloves, I think O.J. hurt his case to a certain extent by mugging when he was putting those on. Those obviously were not his gloves, and the prosecution contention that they shrank was effectively rebutted.
Interesting whether he tries on the civil without anything underneath. If he feels confident that they didn't fit, and he's the only one that knows, he puts that on, that's going to be one heck of a demo for that jury. But, you know, there's another interesting thing. For all that blood there, and you see the Bruno Magli footprints, there isn't one solid footprint. In other words, that Bruno Magli almost looks like a rubber stamp, the base. It's almost like cut-out letters. That's how it is.
Hmm.
You step in blood, you at least, when you, the first footprint should be clear, yet none of the footprints are full footprints.
Hmm.
They're partials. They're either, you know, a heel and part of the sole, but not a total one. Yet the claim is whoever did it walked very slowly. Which means they're impressed. And by the way, only a couple of them were ever analyzed.
Right.
Of those five blood drops in the back, I think only two ever showed up with DNA. The other two were inconclusive, and number 113 was definitely, they couldn't get anything.
Mm.
But you get to the back gate. Now, in 160 feet, you got five blood drops. But for some reason, whoever opened the back gate bled three drops, all right, on the in the center of the gate. Not on the edge where you would normally pick and open the gate. If you had only had one glove, you at least would open it with the gloved hand. If you opened it with the ungloved hand, you would have left a fingerprint,
mm-hmm.
which they didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
But if you opened it, why would you, at that point now, bleed three drops? If you only bled in, and it's 160 feet, only five, it doesn't make any sense. The only thing lacking, I keep saying, was the business card of O.J. Simpson in Nicole's hand. And that would have been, you know, a perfect case.
Well, it's very interesting. In your forensic grasp, which is, as to me, is as interesting as the larger framework or superstructure of the race war information that you received. Joseph Bosco, in his book, A Problem of Evidence, which would repay reading by anyone interested, he quotes Dr. Lee at length, and Dr. Lee says, a strange crime scene, part composed, part not composed.
That's correct.
One of the things that struck me, too, on the one hand, O.J. Simpson has to, assuming that he did the killings, and obviously none of us believes he did, but he would have had to have been a master criminal to dispose of the clothes, the shoes, the murder weapon. None of those have ever been found. And yet he's the ultimate klutz, leaving the watch cap and the one glove there and then dropping the other one behind the house. And
dropping it in his truck so he can pick up the red fibers. Don't forget that.
It's sort of a dichotomy, and Donald Freed, you pointed out that with regard to the prosecution's case and the criminal trial, that on the one hand, O.J. Simpson was, you know, cold and calculating, and on the other hand, you know, he was a wild man out of control. And
that's,
I think,
right.
that sort of...
Yes, you're right, David. There's several psychological profiles that are being collated here. By the prosecution, the propagandists, the plaintiffs, and so on. And once again, you're going to have to wonder, what will this jury think when and if no experts are put on the stand to link O.J. Simpson to this? Now, if this it becomes a question of jealousy and rage and so forth, that can only happen if, for some reason, the judge takes the further step of stopping the more timeline questioning. And if he does that, then we have an outrage.
I'll tell you, there's another curious piece of evidence that's never been brought out. There's a blue denim jacket that was in the kitchen. In fact, they tried to make something of it in the civil. Why it was never brought up in the criminal, I'll never understand. But Risky said that they were discussing if it belonged to any of the victims.
Hmm.
Now, in the sidebar, by the way, in the civil, because I've read that, where the judge says, well, you can't speculate on things like that. And they were saying that Mark Furman, we're going to have evidence that Mark Furman took that blue Levi jacket.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know the exact meaning of it, but I'll tell you one thing. If that belonged to Ron Goldman, you have Ron Goldman in the house. That blows all that time frame.
Hmm.
If it's somebody else's that was in there, that raises a whole new area.
Hmm.
But there is the blue Levi jacket. It's talked about in one line in the criminal, and it's talked about in several lines now in the civil. And Baker says he's going to have some sort of thing to show, because it was a sidebar with the judge, that Mark Furman, we're going to show that Mark Furman took that jacket.
Hmm.
Just
go ahead.
Well, this is a bit off the wall, but I have been contacted by many people from many different places as a result of my involvement in this. But I have recently been speaking with a woman out in L.A. who sounds like she knows what she's talking about. And I throw this out as nothing but speculation, but she says that somebody else was in the house that night with Nicole. And this person has told this story to several different people. This is not the person that Pat McKenna has talked about seeing out in, or, you know, McKenna has talked about it as someone who was seen out in front of Bundy at around 10 o'clock.
Donald Freed.
Well, that's fascinating. Let's hear a little more about that.
I have just been talking with a woman who is very well connected out there, and I don't, again, I don't know how much credence to put in it, but she has apparently been fairly close to people who were in that circle, you know, the whole mm-hmm. Goldman, Faye Resnick, Nicole circle. And they're, that is basically the story that I've been told, and that this person was there when something began to happen, and this person left very quickly.
Well, has she been in touch with the defense?
I have suggested that very strongly, and I am trying to get something done. It's like a lot of these situations that we run into, I believe some fragments of what I've heard. I'm not sure if I believe the whole thing, and I've tried to get her to do that, and I'm still working on it. So, again, the astonishing thing about it to me is that I think we just don't know yet. You know, what
there's
actually
some other interesting material that's come out. I think Donald Freed
off here fairly soon.
All righty. Well, if Stephen Singer, if you have to depart, we'll do this because we're almost at the end of this particular side, and maybe that we'll take a break here and do that. This does conclude this particular half-hour segment. We've been speaking with, once again, Stephen Wirth, along with Carl Jaspers, the co-author of Blood Oath, The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, softcover, Rainbow Books, 1996. Stephen Singer, the author of Legacy of Deception, softcover, Dove, 1995. And Donald Freed, along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, saw a hardcover edition, Macmillan, copyright 1996. For Stephen Wirth, Stephen Singer, and Donald Freed, my name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.